The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Retail Crackdown. North Carolina is taking action and chasing down organized retail crime as small and big retailers alike get rocked with heavy losses. And the cover story article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Crime and Punishment. From Fortune 500 to small business, retailers get rocked with organized crime. Written by Laura Brumette. When Nicole Denny's phone rang on a December morning in 2021, it wasn't a potential customer inquiring about store hours or merchandise. Her small boutique in Cary specializes in selling consignment designer clothing and handbags. The store, Jayador Boutique, is nestled in a quaint shopping center next to a tapas bar and a popular bakery near a Lowe's Foods grocery store in Cary's Fred G. Bond Metro Park. By way of credit card fraud, a group had stolen around $20,000 worth of purses from the boutique, and Denny wanted answers. The problem she faced was one that hundreds of retailers, big and small, are increasingly encountering as retail crime is at a historic high and store losses are increasing exponentially. The acts are known as organized retail crime, often consisting of individuals stealing merchandise from stores and handing it off to larger groups to resell the items at a discounted price. When retailers incur substantial losses, the cost is often passed along to the consumer. Costs from higher insurance premiums, lost merchandise, and advanced security measures mean higher prices for shoppers. Though retail crime has been happening for years, activity has increased since the pandemic began and is causing serious problems for retailers. Organized retail crime accounted for more than $94.5 billion in losses for retailers in the U.S. in 2021, according to the National Retail Foundation. These are people who oftentimes have criminal histories. Sometimes we've seen people with violent criminal histories engaging in it or just general criminal histories, too, says Lieutenant Scott Womack, a detective with the Raleigh Police Department. And oftentimes the big overlay we see is it's people with drug histories. In 2021, organized retail crime cost businesses in North Carolina a total of $3.34 billion. That's combining lost product costs, higher insurance costs, increased price of goods, unrealized wages, and more, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The total value of stolen merchandise in the state was just under $2 billion, and the amount of lost tax revenue reached $355 million across state, local, and federal collections. The widespread nature of the crime, crossing jurisdictions and state lines, can make it difficult to persecute. Many of the instances are even tied to more serious crime rings. But North Carolina has emerged as one of the nation's leaders in taking action against this specific theft. New legislation enacted in December makes the Tar Heel State one of the few to adopt serious laws addressing the crimes, and retailers are hoping it makes a difference. Professional thieves. Petty shoplifters have been around since the dawn of retail stores, with thieves snagging merchandise without paying for it for their own personal use. But organized retail crime isn't just petty theft. Those involved are professionals, repeat offenders who are strategic in their tactics and act with the goal of making a profit. The average age of these offenders is 37 years old, Womack says. The stolen items are resold at flea markets, makeshift brick-and-mortar locations, or online via third-party marketplaces, and in some cases that profit is used to fund other criminal enterprises, including narcotics, money laundering, and human trafficking. Retailers of all sizes and specialties have been hit, but certain products are more attractive to organized retail crime. Over-the-counter products, health and beauty items, infant formula, and razor blades are all common targets, says Elizabeth Robinson, senior vice president at the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association. Those merchandise categories are places where consumers are often looking to find the cheapest price possible. Since the goods are stolen, making them essentially free inventory, criminals can resell the items at discounted prices while still turning a major profit. As technology has evolved, so have the methods for stealing, Robinson says. Some thieves switch the barcodes on merchandise while in the store, allowing them to check out and pay, for instance, $20 for a $400 power tool. Then the thief can bring the power tool back to the store and issue a return and receive the full $400 in the form of a store gift card. Some still use smash-and-grab techniques or push-outs where they fill carts with merchandise and then push the cart straight out of the store's front door, sometimes wielding a mace or other weapons. In recent months, videos have swirled around social media showing teams of people robbing Sephora stores across the country. The perpetrators are seen sweeping shelves of products into bags, often targeting the high-end perfume aisle, as employees stand powerlessly watching and customers run screaming. Those more forceful methods were made easier when the pandemic sparked a labor shortage for many retailers, meaning less staff on hand in stores. Once the merchandise is stolen, it often gets handed to larger crime outfits with the ability to resell mass amounts of product. North Carolina's location and connectivity make it a prime target for such activity. We see these crossing not only county lines, but also state lines. A lot of times you see some of the same criminal rings that are operating up and down the interstates, going from city to city and state to state, Robinson says. North Carolina is sort of a center point for that, with our intersection of 85 and 95 and 40. In November, a team of law enforcement officers busted an organized retail crime ring in a heavily armed showdown in Kings Mountain. The ring managed to steal roughly $5 million of merchandise from Charlotte area retail stores, according to investigators. The group, led by Kings Mountain resident Jeremy Huffman, featured dozens of people stealing over-the-counter drugs from retailers like CVS, Walgreens, Publix, Target, and Walmart, and selling them online. In September 2021, a similar bust occurred in Cabarrus County, just northeast of Charlotte. Five people were charged with running an organized retail crime ring, and about $400,000 of stolen merchandise was recovered from a Harrisburg home, according to the Cabarrus County Sheriff's Office. The thieves were selling stolen power tools, diapers, baby formula, laundry detergent, and small appliances in online marketplaces and from a home. It took about 50 people working with the Sheriff's Office more than 12 hours to move and inventory the stolen goods, according to reports. Upstairs rooms were stacked floor to ceiling with diapers and other new merchandise throughout the house, investigators said in a press release at the time. A small business nightmare. The subject of the phone call from the handbag thieves to Denny in December 2021 was concerning a package she had received in the mail. That morning, a box was delivered to J. Adore Boutique with postage from Brooklyn, New York. Inside were five of the purses that had been stolen from the boutique. The orders had been placed on her website using a fraudulent credit card, unbeknownst to Denny, with requests for overnight shipping. The charges weren't processed by the credit card company until after the bags were already safely to their intended target. The company reclaimed the money and Denny was left empty-handed. Denny had reported the thefts to the police when they happened, but when it became apparent that not much would come of it, she began to seek justice herself. The addresses of where the purses were delivered matched with a halfway house of sorts in New York for rehabilitating youth. She started making calls to the house, the organization running it, and the New York Police Department, hoping to track down her bags. Eventually, the pressure worked, and Denny received a call from the thieves themselves asking what she wanted. Her merchandise back, Denny answered, a straightforward reply, but not one that the perpetrators wanted to hear. Several phone calls took place over the course of days discussing returning her bags with different people on the other end of the phone, though all were young females, Denny says. She could hear the fear in some of their voices. But to Denny's surprise, the thieves followed through with sending back five of the bags. The box was worth between $10,000 and $15,000 to Denny, but two bags, both rare, were still missing. The pair was worth over $5,000. So when the call came that morning asking if she was satisfied, Denny says she wasn't. She told the caller she was now planning to press charges. That night at 4 a.m., J. Adore Boutique was robbed. I can't say for sure that it was the same people that robbed me, but it's just a strange coincidence that I was robbed that night after that phone call, she says. I had gotten kind of close to these people. They had my phone number, they knew where I lived, and they did all their research on me as I had done research on them. That's when the threatening phone calls began, promising someone was coming to her store. Individuals would intermittently come into the store and walk the perimeter of it, seemingly canvassing the space, Denny says. One male walked around the store with a bandana covering his face. When looking at security camera footage, he appeared to have a gun in his waistband, Denny says. After that instance, Denny closed the store down until she could figure out what to do. I started researching all kinds of security. I shut down the online store. I dumped all the money I could into securing my store, she says. My employees essentially all quit, and I can't blame them. It was scary, and no job pays enough to put your life in jeopardy like that. After several weeks of being closed, J'adore Boutique reopened with all new security measures. The threatening calls and visits stopped. Though a sense of safety was restored to the business, the ordeal cost Denny over $80,000 in stolen inventory, extra security costs, weeks of closure, and lost staff. Denny does have insurance for her store, and they did issue her a payout when the store was physically robbed. But as a small business, she holds a fear that insurance could drop her if more incidents pile up. It was very important that I put in measures to secure my store for that reason. You can't just keep having insurance pay out, she says. It's wrong, first of all, and then second of all, they're not going to continue to pay out. Advanced defense. Organized retail crime isn't just a problem for small businesses. Fortune 500 company Lowe's Home Improvement has been hit countless times with this kind of theft and is answering by developing its own technology solution to combat it. The North Carolina-based retailer enlisted its Innovation Labs team to create Project Unlock. The solution, currently in the early stage proof of concept stage, deactivates power tools while they are on the shelf. The tools aren't activated until after a customer pays at checkout. The solution allows for theft deterrence without adding friction for customers. At the moment, the technology only works on power tools, though the company believes it could work across other products with electrical components as well. Lowe sees a future where capabilities like Project Unlock can help positively impact the entire retail ecosystem, says Scott Dreyer, Vice President of Asset Protection at Lowe's. We are leveraging this technology investment to spark a broader industry conversation about how emerging technology can help combat organized retail crime. The retail giant currently has more than 1,700 stores in the U.S., with over a dozen in the Triangle. When organized retail crime events happen in Lowe's stores, associates report the incident to the company's in-house security and loss prevention experts known as asset protection. The team works with law enforcement to investigate and manage incidents. Lowe's has also been active in working with policymakers to get legislation passed on organized retail crime. Last April, a member of the company's investigations team briefed members of the state's Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety on the gravity of organized retail crime. The Lowe's representative told the legislators that in one calendar year, the retailer saw millions of dollars worth of merchandise stolen. The rises in commodity prices seen over the past 2 years following global supply chain issues meant the theft of items like copper increased at Lowe's stores. The retailer stores oriented strand board, or OSB, outside for the ease of customers, often contractors, that frequently purchase it, but that also makes it easy for thieves to drive up a truck or trailer and take large amounts of product. 10 sheets of the board stolen could mean $300 lost in just one truckload, according to the presentation. The legislative pen is mighty. In fighting organized retail crime, legislation is the key, says Maria Michelle Manzo, a division chief with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Comprehensive legislation has yet to be passed on the federal level, but North Carolina jumped to the forefront of the fight last year with the passage of a new bill. The law, in effect as of December, takes multiple stabs at curbing theft and protecting retailers in the state. It creates a new Class F felony for perpetrators who steal $50,000 and up from one or more retail stores over a 90-day period. If $100,000 or more is stolen, the perpetrators could see a Class C felony charge with a sentence of between 4 to 15 years in prison. It gives retailers a stronger stick to swing with to protect them against crime, says Representative Robert Reeves, who helped pass the legislation. It's a disincentive for theft and for these types of activities, and the more disincentives you put out there, the better off everybody is, because a mom and pop may seem to feel the same thing as a Walmart. In addition to stronger punishments, the legislation allows retailers to recoup damages for the property stolen, as well as damage caused during the crime, such as broken windows. It also makes an effort to curb online marketplaces from selling stolen merchandise. Third-party sellers on sites such as Facebook Marketplace and Amazon that have $20,000 in gross revenue annually must provide a full name, phone number, and physical address in order to operate their account, according to the new law. The piece of legislation faced no opposition from either side of the aisle, Reeve says. The Inform Consumers Act, focused exclusively on verification for third-party sellers, was passed by the U.S. Congress at the end of last year. A larger bill aiming to combat organized retail crime was introduced in the U.S. Senate earlier this year, but has not yet progressed. It could lead to less stores to shop in, prices going up. It's something that affects everybody, Michelle Manzo says. Everybody has an interest. Now the legislation needs to get passed at the federal level. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Big changes on Atlantic Avenue. Not long ago, the Atlantic Avenue corridor in Raleigh was a rusty, neglected part of town whose highlights were the Circus Restaurant and Watkins Grill, but that has changed and fast. Now, new apartments are about to open in Raleigh Iron Works in a 7-story residential development called Forge. The project, which will welcome new occupants in June, continues an apartment trend of less space and more amenities. Of the 219 units, 170 will be micro, studio, or one-bedroom units ranging from 430 to 865 square feet. The remaining units will be two bedrooms that range from 966 to 1200 square feet, and some studios include a nifty combination of a desk and bed, where the bed slides under the desk to create extra space. Rental rates start at $1,375 a month. Efficiently sized apartments are becoming more popular in the multifamily space, says Chris Girard, Director of Property Management at Grub Ventures. With a host of high-design amenities at your fingertips, many renters don't feel the need to maintain and upkeep 900-plus square feet of space. In other words, the renters have a building with a fitness center, swimming pool, upper-level courtyard, and even a podcast studio, and Forge is part of the Raleigh Ironworks development, a combined project of Grub Ventures of Raleigh and Jamestown of Atlanta. Grub Ventures, of course, jump-started the reinvention of the area with the Dock 1053 project that turned an old warehouse into a lively destination. Meanwhile, the Circus Restaurant is gone, but Watkins Grill, which dates to 1947, will be happy to serve new residents a country-style steak. Huge crowds expected as Blue Angels fly in Goldsboro. The U.S. Navy Blue Angels, one of the most popular groups in aviation, will be performing in Goldsboro next month. The Blue Angels will headline the Wings Over Wayne Air Show at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base May 20 to 21st. The last time the Blue Angels headlined the air show in 2017, they attracted more than 200,000 spectators. We look forward to showcasing the combat-proven F-A-18 Super Hornet, the mainstay of modern naval air power, and the C-130J Super Hercules, the premier logistics support aircraft of the U.S. Marine Corps, says Blue Angels commanding officer and flight leader Alexander Armadas. Both aircraft operate worldwide, carrying out the Navy and Marine Corps mission, he says. Beloved Suttons celebrates 100. College Main Streets often see high turnover rates among tenants, but a Chapel Hill business has reached a major milestone. Sutton's Drugstore, located on Franklin Street near the University of North Carolina, is now 100 years old. The store dates to April 1923, meaning the business has seen a world war, the Great Depression, 18 different U.S. presidents, and the global coronavirus pandemic. And the store, now also a restaurant and event space, is still going strong. The current owner, Don Pinney, bought the business in 2014. That same year, the pharmacy side of the business closed. NC State fills dean position. NC State University's search to fill a long-standing vacancy at the top of one of its largest schools has come to an end. The university has named Gary Fox as the next dean of its College of Agriculture and Life Sciences effective August 1, pending approval by the Board of Trustees. The move is a promotion for Fox, who joined NC State in 2017 as a professor and head of its Department of Biological and Agricultural Engineering. End of an era in North Carolina. The Sears era is coming to an end in North Carolina. The last location left in the state for the once prolific department store chain at Friendly Center in Greensboro is closing. A large banner announcing the coming closure hangs on the front of the Sears store at the retail center, and closing sales are underway. A specific closing date has not been announced. CBL Properties, which owns and operates the shopping center that dates to 1957, says plans are underway for filling the space. The Sears closure is the first step of an active redevelopment plan, which provides CBL the opportunity to redevelop prime real estate at one of our top-performing properties, CBL says. And finally, The Mill opens. Finally, fans of the former Edwards Mill Bar and Grill have a reason to return to their old spot. The Mill, a new restaurant long in the works, has opened at Old Raleigh Village. The new concept from Urban Food Group fills the space that has been empty since 2020. The space has been updated, including an expanded outdoor patio. There is a wood-burning grill, and the restaurant serves steak, fish, chicken, and more. The bar options include nachos and wings. And now we turn to some of the major news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one, written by Lauren Onisorge, surprise tax bills leave small businesses scrambling. Unexpected tax bills are hitting startups across the country due to a congressional decision not to extend a key tax provision tied to research and development expenses. Lawmakers in Washington did not extend a provision last year that allows for R&D costs to be fully expensed under Section 174 of the tax code. It stinks for software companies, says Chris Geis, whose company, Saguno Software in Durham, allows firms to track email marketing. What counts as R&D is a little crazy to me because it's kind of every feature, software product you put out there. You're constantly evolving it and improving it, and they say those things count toward R&D. So pretty much the majority of your engineering salary is going toward that. While some big companies were prepared, many startups only learned of the switch after receiving tax bills. Eva Garland of Eva Garland Consulting in Raleigh says some clients are facing a really tough decision with surprise tax bills. The Small Software Business Owners Alliance recently called Section 174 an existential threat to small software businesses and demanded congressional action. The tax code now requires R&D amortization over a period of 5 years, potentially creating a mathematical mismatch for software firms whose largest R&D line item is typically software development talent. But life sciences firms are also feeling the strain, Garland says. Larry Robbins of Robbins, Wyrick, Robbins, Yates, and Ponton says the statute could force startups to raise capital in an uncertain environment just to pay taxes. The tax code as it stands reduces the current deduction to 20% of software developer salaries paid. As such, 80% of the normal developer deductions are not available to shelter income generated during a given year. In theory, if developer costs are stable or growing at a slow pace, by the end of the fifth year, the companies would be back to deducting all developer salaries. That includes deductions of 20% for each of the past 5 years. Unfortunately, between now and that fifth year, there will be, for many software developer-heavy companies, a mismatch of expenses against income, and these companies will need to raise capital to pay the taxes, Robin says. Lee County may add industrial park. Helix Ventures seeks to develop park on nearly 900 acres. This article written by Evan Hoopfer. A huge industrial park is being proposed in Lee County by a local development group that's been part of some giant economic development projects in the Triangle. Helix Ventures recently proposed to develop a new industrial park totaling 885 acres in the fast-growing county. The proposal was submitted to the Sanford-Lee County Broadway Technical Review Committee, which is scheduled to review the project at its April 27 meeting. The park would be called Helix Innovation Park at the Brickyard, and the land would need to be rezoned and annexed. A proposal for a fully amenitized, modern, advanced manufacturing industrial park for the benefit of new companies and the surrounding community, says a description of the project on the agenda for the TRC meeting. The park will have the optionality to attract a wide range of projects from local business to large economic development projects from all over the world, it reads. Details in the application are sparse, as going through the TRC is one of the first steps developers take in Lee County when proposing a project. At a later date, the project could be taken up by the Sanford City Council or Lee County Board of Commissioners for approval or denial. It appears that the development team intends to break the 885 acres into several pods, ranging in size from a dozen acres to more than 130, according to a master plan submitted to the TRC. The park would sit in the northern part of Lee County along U.S. Highway 15501. The location is also just south of the Deep River, which acts as the boundary between Chatham and Lee counties. Helix Ventures did not respond to a request for comment. The company is active in Lee County, as in December, It purchased 213 acres for just over $7 million next to Raleigh Executive Jetport to also build a new business park. At the time, Jonathan Keener, principal of Helix Ventures, said the company was working on Helix Innovation Park at the Brickyard, too. Helix Ventures has helped bring big-name companies to the Triangle. In the past, the company has partnered with the town of Holly Springs to help land Fujifilm Diasynth Biotechnologies and Amgen at Helix's two life sciences parks in the town. And our next article is written by Kaylee Thompson. Triangle properties land on CMBS watch list. The long-term impact of the pandemic on commercial real estate is being felt across the Triangle as several properties are now watch-listed. As of March, 8 Triangle properties tied to commercial mortgage-backed securities were on the CMBS watch list. Properties are put on the watch list for having late debt payments or when they're facing challenges that may lead to owners having trouble making future payments. The watch list updates are filed monthly by loan servicers. The shift to remote work has left empty office spaces across the region and country. Vacancy rates are up and available sublease space is climbing. Meanwhile, the hotel industry continues to face headwinds as business travel remains depressed. Three hotels on the watch list are the 249-unit DoubleTree by Research Triangle Park, 177-unit Hilton Garden Inn, Raleigh-Durham Research Triangle Park, and the 149-unit Courtyard by Marriott, Raleigh-Cary. Elsewhere, the Briar Creek Corporate Center 5, a 127,500-square-foot office building at 8051 Arco Corporate Drive, is also on the list. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Airlines and Startups page written by Lauren Onasorge. As planes get bigger, RDU looks at options, airport-built terminals with a primary focus on small regional jets. A pilot shortage and a resurgence in travel demand has air carriers, from Delta Airlines to American Airlines, looking at bigger planes to get passengers to and from their destinations. Larger planes sell more seats per flight, but at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, where the largest terminal was not designed for today's big jets, it's creating challenges. It's another reason why airport executives say expansion is critical to staying competitive. When Terminal 2 was built, Bill Sandifer, Chief Development Officer for the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority, says there were a lot of 50-seat regional jets in the market. Those are pretty small in terms of wingspan and length of fuselage, he says. The 36-gate terminal can accommodate 36 of those regional jets, but different size planes mean different capacities for the terminal. Supporting just narrow-body jets makes only 31 gates usable. Add in wide-body aircraft surrounded by narrow-body planes, and the number drops to 29. It's a puzzle. And should more airlines seek to maximize their efficiency by adding wide-body planes, the puzzle could get more complicated for RDU. But it's also where plans... But it's also where plans to update Terminal 2 come in. Terminal 1 is specifically designed for narrow-body planes, Sandifer says. Regularly landing a 777 at that terminal isn't an option, meaning any expansion to accommodate larger jets would need to happen at Terminal 2. He says the plan is to evolve a little bit away from how the building was planned in the early 2000s, no longer considering small regional jet aircraft. But Terminal 2 can't expand until the new runway is built and the old one is moved. That means additional gates will not be added until 2030 at the earliest. Due to geography, Terminal 2 would max out at 53 gates. In February, RDU CEO Mike Landgath told the airport board the team was already thinking past Terminal 2, perhaps to a multi-billion Terminal 3 in the future. Local fashion brand lands Nordstrom deal. A bootstrapped fashion brand has landed in Nordstrom thanks to a TikTok video and its viral stars, a pair of entrepreneurs celebrating South Asian culture through apparel. Nikki Shamdasani, who co-founded fashion startup Sani in Raleigh with her sister, Ritika, says it started with a problem. It's hard to shop for Indian weddings in the U.S., Nikki Shamdasani says. What they were able to find in the U.S. was hardly the most recent styles on Instagram, so they decided to solve the problem themselves. We didn't end up having to sew the clothes, she said, pointing to the tailoring industry in India. Her grandmother used to go to fabric stores and bring cloth to a local tailor to get something custom made. So the sisters brought their fabric choices to India and quickly realized the entrepreneurial possibilities. And finally, Durham startup grows haul to $165 million. With the addition of $65 million in new financing, Durham sports technology firm Teamworks has raised a total of $165 million, the company announced this month. It's a large haul, particularly in light of current macroeconomics. Does that mean there is an exit, possibly an initial public offering in Teamworks' future? Mitch Heath, co-founder of Teamworks, says the company is open to all outcomes. I think we've always had a mindset of just grow a great business, he says. Don't focus too much on trying to position for a certain outcome. Build a great business and great things will happen. But we are further along in the journey, so we have to look at what those potential outcomes might be. Now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page written by Evan Hoopfer. Plans rejected for multifamily complex. Clayton developer goes back to drawing board. A Johnston County developer is rethinking its strategy after the Clayton Town Council rejected its plans for a new multifamily complex. Lipscomb Development wanted to build a housing development along North O'Neill Street, about a mile northeast of downtown Clayton, that would have included 100 condominiums and 30 townhomes. But in March, the town council rejected a rezoning request for the land. Council members expressed trepidation about the amount of additional traffic that would come to North O'Neill Street. Right now, we're just regrouping, says James Lipscomb of Lipscomb Development. An LLC run by prominent Triangle developer D.R. Bryan of Chapel Hill-based Bryan Properties purchased the land, comprised of about 40 acres, for $754,500, according to a deed filed April 10. Lipscomb says Bryan is a mentor of his. He bought the property and is holding it while Lipscomb figures out how to develop it. The plan is for Lipscomb to eventually buy the property back from Bryan. Lipscomb and Emily Bedingfield, planning and entitlement manager at Lipscomb Development, says the company is working out how to develop the land in a way in which they don't have to go back to the town council for approval. The land is currently zoned residential estate, which is the classification for the lowest density housing in Clayton. Lipscomb says the goal is to have a new development plan within the next quarter or so. Buyer grabs Eastern North Carolina event space. A well-known convention center in Wilson has traded hands. Royal Blue Event Center, which already has a location in Garner, purchased the 18,000-square-foot Bill Ellis Convention Center in Wilson for $850,000, according to a deed filed March 16. The convention center sits at the corner of Downing and Forest Hills Roads on the southwest side of town. Marie Cruz Peralta, president of Royal Blue Event Center, says the Bill Ellis Convention Center will be used for weddings, quinceañeras, and other events. Bill Ellis, who died in 2017, was a legend in the Eastern North Carolina barbecue scene. He started his restaurant in 1963 and eventually grew the business into an enterprise that included the restaurant, catering business, convention center, and a hog farm. Bill Ellis Barbecue Restaurant closed in 2019. And finally, home builder buys 100-plus acres for $1.6 million. An LLC addressed to Kings Mill Homes purchased 113 acres in Wilson for $1.57 million, according to a deed filed March 30. The purchase price comes out to about $13,800 an acre. The land sits behind the Lowe's Home Improvement at the intersection of Forest Hills Road and Raleigh Road Parkway West. The land has an assessed value of $558,000, according to Wilson County property records, and was previously owned by a farm. And now we turn to the page written by Laura Bramette on retail and restaurants. Chef Kumar plans new restaurant in Raleigh. With Garland closed, she looks to open Aja later this spring, and that's Aja spelled A-J-J-A. Local diners mourn the loss of a downtown Raleigh favorite when Garland closed its doors last year, but the restaurant's owners are back with a new concept. Acclaimed chef Chidi Kumar and partner Paul Seiler are opening Aja in Raleigh's Five Points neighborhood later this spring. Its menu, helmed by Kumar and chef Chris Gamble, will feature diverse foodways and cultures, vibrant spices and cooking techniques of the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and beyond. Aja will be located at 209 Bickett Boulevard in the same building as Anisette's Sweet Shop. The new concept will take up 1,800 square feet inside and feature a large covered outdoor patio with a fire pit and views of the city's skyline. Aja will have an outdoor bar connecting to the restaurant's interior dining room as well as access from the kitchen directly to the patio. In total, the restaurant will have about 70 seats. Kumar declines to disclose the project's cost. The menu will include shareable plates and entrees, including skewered grilled meats, veggies, and bright and herbaceous flavors, they say. In Southwest Asia and the Global South at large, the meal consists of many shared components. Each bite can provide a different experience, Kumar says. In these parts of the world, the simple gesture of welcoming a guest with food and drink is a deep-rooted tradition. The table is about abundance and intentional generosity. We are excited to embody this spirit of hospitality at Asia, or Aja. Garland, which served Indian and Asian dishes with a southern twist, closed in August. The spot was a fixture in the downtown dining scene and led Kumar to receiving multiple James Beard Award nominations. The Garland space at 14 West Martin Street remains empty, but the other two floors have reopened as Neptune's Bar and music venue King's. We're working through level by level. King's is coming back to life, and we're figuring out who the prominent players in that are going to be, Kumar says. Martin and Aaron Wheeler are operating Neptune's, and then Garland has got a few options, but we're just kind of working through that right now, she says. Bull Box opens Garner Chapel Hill restaurants. Bull Box, spelled B-U-L, and then Box, B-O-X, a Raleigh restaurant brand, has added Chapel Hill and Garner locations. The company opened at Transfer Company Food Hall in 2016 and now has 7 locations. Other locations include Morrisville, North Hills, Transfer Company Food Hall in Hillsborough Street in Raleigh, and University Hill in Durham. The Garner restaurant is located in the White Oak Crossing Shopping Center at 160 Shenstone Boulevard. The Chapel Hill restaurant is located in the former Lime and Basil space at 200 West Franklin Street. The Bull Box menu features customizable bowls with Korean, Japanese, Thai, and Chinese influences. And finally, Renaissance Hotel plan for Hub RTP. Renaissance Hotels, a luxury hotel brand under Marriott International, is planning a new location in Research Triangle Park as part of the Hub RTP development, bringing residential, retail, office, and hospitality space to RTP. Site plans filed with the City of Durham show a hotel with 17 levels and 254 rooms across 283,000 square feet. The Renaissance RTP would be a full-service hotel. The Triangle area has one other Renaissance hotel located in North Hills. Site plans show a club lounge, restaurant, pool, outdoor dining space, and seating across 2 patio levels and a parking deck with about 250 spaces. The hotel would also feature meeting and event space, including a main and a junior ballroom. Now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Kaylee Thompson. Dilweg releases Cary property to lender. Vacancies high at Regency Lakeview as Dilweg pulls out. Dilweg, a prominent commercial real estate firm in Durham, recently released a mostly vacant office property back to its lender in a microcosm of the headwinds the industry is facing. Dilweg gave Regency Lakeview and Cary back to the lender in November. CEO Anthony Dilweg says the company was looking to restructure its financing tied to the property, but the lender had a different view of the value. It's a scenario that could become a common theme across the commercial real estate industry, with vacancy rates rising as companies consolidate office space and large tenants being few and far between for existing properties and new developments. Lenders are tightening up on developers. Certainly we're disappointed, Dilweg says. To me, you've got to make decisions like that. You've got to do the best you can with insights, you know, markers, and we'll probably have a few more here in the second quarter. It all depends on how the lenders behave. You've got to have the courage to give the keys back. Dilweg acquired 9,000 and 11,000 Regency Parkway in January 2017 in a deal worth $61 million. Both properties were 100% occupied at the time. In Q4 2022, there was 118,693 square feet of space available at 9,000 Regency, a more than 90% vacancy rate, and 101,963 at 11,000 Regency, a 40% vacancy rate, according to Triangle Business Journal's Space publication. The buildings combined totaled more than 378,000 square feet of rentable space. Dilwig does not name the lender tied to the properties, but according to the Wake County property records, the company gave the rights to the office buildings to Bridge Investment Group of Utah and New York. The firm declines to comment. Dilwig says the company will likely release a few more properties in the second quarter, though he wouldn't disclose which ones. It's a move Dilwig is still figuring out as negotiations are ongoing. New office space pitched in Southwest Wake. A pair of office buildings are planned in Apex, even as office vacancies are on the rise. Daniel and Terry Kugler submitted site plans with the town for Sutton Point, a small office park on Roberts Road with a Cary address. It's west of Highway 540 and near Green Level High School. The site plans are for a modification to a previously approved office building and for a second office building. One will be a two-story building that's 8,400 square feet, and the other will be a three-story building totaling 28,119 square feet. The plans come as demand for office space has diminished, as most companies now use some form of hybrid work. The region's vacancy rate for office space was 13.37% in the fourth quarter of 2022, and the amount of available sublease space is growing. Some landlords have tried to combat their vacancy rate by loading up office buildings with amenities. And finally, apartments planned for East Raleigh. A real estate firm in Greenville is planning an apartment community inside the Beltline in Raleigh with a yoga center, billiard room, and cooking demonstration area. Taft Development Group has filed site permits for a 195-unit apartment complex at 1031 North King Charles Road, not far from Lions Park, an area that is seeing intense interest thanks to its proximity to downtown. There will be studios, one- and two-bedroom units. The residential units will be spread among three-story buildings. Interior features include granite countertops and stand-up glass showers. Studios will be around 485 square feet and will rent for $1,350 a month. And our last reporter page is Zach Ezone's on healthcare. RTP's Science 37 has second round of cuts. Firm reduces jobs in U.S. and Europe, looks to invest more in Asia. Science 37, a public company headquartered in Research Triangle Park, is cutting nearly one-third of its workforce in the U.S. and Europe in its latest round of layoffs. Science 37 recently disclosed plans to trim its workforce by about 140 employees, or roughly 30%, to reduce costs. As it cuts jobs in the U.S. and Europe, the company plans to invest in centers in India, Pakistan, and Slovakia. The company expects to generate annual gross cash savings of about $24 million, according to a U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission filing. Science 37 ended last year with 460 full-time employees and had about 85 employees and contractors in the regions around India, Pakistan, and Slovakia. Science 37 plans to further invest in this area and these areas by opening three global centers of excellence in those countries, which will employ a total of nearly 200 people by the end of 2023. CEO David Coleman said Science 37's existing level of selling, general and administrative expenses, which totaled about $103.3 million in 2022, makes the company's goal of cash flow positivity by the end of 2024 a high hurdle. The company ended last year with about $108.1 million in cash and a net loss of $51 million. The expenses were the result of investments Science 37 made into a new technology platform that launched about 9 months ago. That platform is still supported by high-cost United States-based resources, Coleman said on a conference call. To gain greater operational efficiency, we're introducing a global center of excellence model that will allow us to strengthen and scale our Metasite offering and accelerate our path to profitability. Metasite is the name of the company's virtual clinical trial site that both drug developers and contract research organizations can utilize as a standalone solution or in combination with traditional in-person sites. The company over the past several quarters has delivered Metasite at a gross margin below 25%, which isn't sustainable, he said. The sub 25% margin has been largely the result of excess capacity given declining revenue because of the market conditions affecting the life sciences industry, Komen added. Raleigh startup raises $36 million for COPD treatment. A small biopharmaceutical company in Raleigh is moving its lead drug candidate into clinical trials after closing a $36 million funding round. The financing provides AER Therapeutics, that's spelled A-E-R, Therapeutics, with a multi-year runway that will cover at least two clinical studies, including a Phase 1 trial set to begin this year, as it evaluates an inhaled treatment for patients of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. AER began its fundraising efforts in the first half of 2022 before funding for life sciences companies really began to dry up. By the end of the year, the company closed out a Series A round that included investors Canaan, OrbiMed, and Durham's Hatteras Venture Partners. The funding round should give the company a runway of about 2.5 years, CEO Jim Schaefer says. AER has built a team of 8 employees, 5 in Raleigh, 2 in Seattle, and 1 in San Francisco. The company also has a board of directors that includes Fahey, Schaefer, and representatives from each of AER's 3 recent investors, including Christy Schaefer, a general partner at Hatteras. And finally, Cipla seeks to dismiss Fennec patent lawsuit. Cipla Limited of India and its U.S. subsidiary, Cipla USA, have requested that a federal court dismiss a complaint by Fennec Pharmaceuticals alleging patent infringement. Durham-based Fennec, alongside Oregon Health and Science University, filed a lawsuit in January against Cipla, claiming infringing on multiple patents that cover Fennec's drug PEDMARK, which the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved in September. By submitting its application to the FDA, Fennec argues that Cipla has infringed one or more claims in patents related to PEDMARK, which is Fennec's sole product. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Sportsbook Law Opens Door for Canes Owner. As the Carolina Hurricanes start their quest to hoist what would be the second Stanley Cup in the franchise's history, North Carolina lawmakers are inching closer to approving a sports betting bill that would make the operation of a physical sports book legal in the state. That should put Canes owner Tom Dundon in a far better mood than, say, last year when the sports betting bill failed to pass and PNC Arena's other big tenant, NC State University, was reluctant to give up on land around Carter-Finley Stadium for Dundon. Two things have or are about to happen that make the picture favorable for Dundon, who may forego thinking about moving the hockey team out of Raleigh for now. First, the 2-year contract extension signed by the current naming rights owner, PNC Bank, allows all parties some extra time to hammer out the long-term detail. But nestled in the contract was an item that was missed by everyone. PNC's name comes off the building in 2 years. Instead, PNC's name will be on the club level of the arena for 7 years, the same time frame signed by the Centennial Authority, the owner and operator of the building, and Dundon's Hockey and Entertainment Company. So what will the arena be called in 2 years? That's where the sportsbook law comes into play. Dundon and other professional team owners have been pushing for lawmakers to pass the sports betting bill so they can construct a sportsbook right beside the stadium. If the bill becomes law, Dundon will now have additional leverage on his hands, naming rights. Say MGM or Harrah's wants a sportsbook to operate in Raleigh. Dundon can now demand the sportsbook operator also agree to the naming rights. MGM Arena, Harrah's Shelter or Caesar Center. This way, Dundon gets money from PNC for an area, club area, that is not sponsored, extra dollars, and he can cut a separate deal for the naming rights of the building. PNC was paying $4 million a year and is expected to pay a lower amount for the club-level sponsor, which easily will be recovered through the new naming rights deal. But there's another twist that has emerged in the past few days that brings me to my second point. Lawmakers are thinking of accelerating the elimination of the corporate income tax, which currently sits at 2.5%. Currently, that tax is scheduled to be zero by 2030. This new bill sitting in the State House would fast-track it. Behind closed doors, there are talks of the measure being inserted in the budget, which is veto-proof in case Governor Roy Cooper does not like the provision. The Republican argument is that the loss of revenue from lowering the tax rate will be replenished by the revenue generated out of sportsbook and other new sources. That, too, is good news for Dundon and, frankly, perhaps everyone who loves the hockey team, the only major league sports franchise in our area. When the sports betting bill becomes law, things will move fast, and folks such as Dundon and Carolina Panthers owner David Tepper are expected to put things in motion. Dundon is about to get what he wanted all along, and hopefully so will we, the return of the Cup after 17 years. And now we'll read some of the big number sections that are sprinkled throughout the Triangle Business Journal. The first big number is 30. That's the number of indictments for Paycheck Protection Program fraud brought last year in the Eastern District of North Carolina, according to U.S. Attorney Mike Easley, Jr. 5,000. Population of Creedmoor in Granville County. The city is considering expanding its extraterritorial jurisdiction, or ETJ, by 1 mile in an effort to better control the growth occurring in and around the city. And our next big number, the percentage, 67%. That's the occupancy rate seen across Wake County hotels in February. The rate climbed higher than the same time period in 2022, 59.5%, but is still below the pre-pandemic levels of 73.1% in 2020 and 71% in 2019. The next number is $275,000. That's how much a one-bedroom, one-bathroom condominium that totals 500 square feet will be listed for in a new project coming to Chapel Hill. And finally, 46%. That's the size of workforce reduction that the biopharmaceutical Asaragen has implemented as it searches for additional capital. The company, which recently went public through a merger, has furloughed 12 workers and implemented salary reductions for certain employees, according to a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. And now we'll read the she said it and he said it quotation sections that are sprinkled throughout the Triangle Business Journal. The first one is from Richie Wallman, founder of Durham-based Written Word Media, who built her company, which helps independent authors promote their titles, without a single dollar of venture capital money. She says, "Look really hard at your business model and ask yourself, is this really something that needs outside capital?" And next, we have Natalie Hawkins, executive director of Moore County Partners in Progress, the county's economic development arm, on the Pinehurst, Southern Pines, Aberdeen area, recently crossing the 50,000 population threshold. "I believe it will also help some of our local transportation projects be more likely to get funded in the state transportation improvement program due to the point prioritization process NCDOT uses." And next, we have a quote from Graham Worth, owner of Charlotte-based Common Market on the brand's new Durham location. "The food, beverage, and retail concept is eyeing a late spring opening after facing construction delays. Our brand is really focused on repurposing existing spaces and in a semi-unique way, and the Durham building was certainly a challenge in that regard." And next is Bob Van Wormer, senior director at Cushman & Wakefield. "Landlords and their lenders are still enjoying reasonably high occupancy levels and not yet feeling the pressure that comes with higher vacancy rates. An empty parking lot doesn't necessarily mean a building owner isn't still collecting rent and servicing its debt." Now we have some news from around the state. This next article is from the Triad Business Journal. Sports retailer to close North Carolina stores. 2 years after filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, Greensboro-based Omega Sports is closing all 7 of its stores, according to a statement the company released on its website. "We are saddened to confirm that Omega Sports will close its stores and shut down its e-commerce operation. This decision was made after conferring with Omega's financial and legal advisors," the company says. Owner and CEO Craig Carlock, who purchased Omega Sports with his wife Kristen for an undisclosed amount in 2017, was named the chief operating officer for the Carroll Companies last month. Craig Carlock was the CEO of the Fresh Market before leaving the Greensboro-based grocery chain in 2015. Omega Sports has three Triad stores, with one each in Greensboro, High Point, and Winston-Salem. It also has two locations in Charlotte and one each in Raleigh at North Hills and Wilmington. Omega had 14 stores as of April 2019, but closed stores in Cary, Durham, Burlington, Morrisville, and Wilson before filing for bankruptcy. The company announced its plans for an orderly wind down of operations through early summer. In its statement, Omega Sports cited challenges presented by COVID-19, supply chain shortages, wage and cost inflation, and economic uncertainties. We are grateful for our incredible team of dedicated employees who have unselfishly and professionally served our customers and communities for over four decades. We are equally thankful for our longtime customers who have been loyal, supportive, and faithful to Omega Sports, the company says in the statement. And our next story is from the Charlotte Business Journal. Truist cuts jobs as it exits segments of business. Truist Financial Corporation is cutting 80 employees in its Atlanta and Memphis, Tennessee offices following plans to exit certain segments of business. The Charlotte-based bank plans to exit sales and trading of mortgage-backed securities, Small Business Administration, and government agency bonds and supported services. Brian Boudreau, a Truist spokesperson, confirmed. Truist did not comment on the headcount reduction. Truist Securities regularly assesses opportunities for our organization and makes adjustments to our business to invest in areas for growth, the bank says in a statement. We made the decision to exit certain aspects of our fixed income sales, research, and trading business by January 2024, and will work closely with our clients to support them during this transition. Patrick Wells, wealth advisor and securities analyst at Pinnacle Associates, says the move comes as the banking crisis drove all institutions to review cost and risk tolerance across their respective businesses. He says Truist's decision to exit these specific segments, however, is most likely a result of continued internal reviews to drive efficiency and improve returns. While this is a normal part of operations, it has taken on added urgency with the uncertain economic outlook and current problems in the banking industry, Wells says. This is not the first round of job cuts for Truist this year. In February, Bloomberg reported the bank eliminated about 5% of its investment banking division following uncertainty in the deal-making climate. Truist, the Triangle's third largest bank, has more than $12 billion in local deposits. And we'll end our reading of the Triangle Business Journal with the Business Pulse Survey. The question, how often do you travel for work-related business? Their total number of responses was 111. 35% say a few times a year. 27% say, I don't travel for work. 22% say monthly. And 16% say weekly. And that'll wrap it up for us as we run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.